On this episode of Never Surrender.
I really feel that I need to tell stories and need to continue to do those things, even when, you know, critics are going to punch me in the face and kick me on the ground, even though, you know, they don't know that, you know, you almost lost your son. They'll continue to write shitty things about the art that you've made. And, you know, it's like, it can be dark, you know? And I think if you let it get to you, or you can be intellectual, go, okay, that's okay. It's almost like when someone's angry at me, I have trouble with that. You know, it's like, I got to be okay with someone not liking what you made and or being angry at you. And that's like a massive life lesson for all people, you know?
I'm Jack Hergeth.
And I'm Stephen Kramer Glickman.
And this is Never Surrender,
the show where we sit down with the most successful people in the entertainment industry to talk about failure and how they pushed through it and never gave up.
Because we've all failed. We've all had setbacks.
Yeah, we've all questioned whether to keep going.
But at some point, everybody struggles.
Yeah, I mean, I've been let go from some of my favorite jobs.
You and me both. We just hope that by listening to this podcast, it will help give you the strength to never surrender.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Our guest today is a quadruple threat. She's an actress, director, producer, and writer. She starred in a number of TV shows and movies, like Bless This Mess, Over Her Dead Body, and No Escape. And as a writer and director, she's worked on films including In a World and I Do Until I Don't.
She's currently starring as the voice of Poison Ivy in the HBO Max animated series Harley Quinn. And with the career she's had, it's hard to believe she's ever failed. But she'll be the first to tell you that life isn't without its share of challenges, and she's here to talk about it.
This is Lake Bell. This is so wonderful. Lake Bell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is so cool.
We're doing it. We're in a black box that's it's very padded so that in case anyone flails, or I gesticulate a lot, so in a way good.
Terrific. Well, that's why it's padded, so if you hit your
That's what I mean. And
hit the
I'm
wall,
protected. I feel very safe.
Yes. Well, you should feel safe. You are a very accomplished actor, writer, and director. You've been in some phenomenal films and animated things, all sorts of shows, television, movies. You've made movies. I've seen movies you've made. But there's one project, an early project of yours I'm very interested in, The Late Lake Show. Let's talk about that show.
Yes, let's talk about that.
The the Late Lake Show?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a swig of water for that.
We're
late
going
Lake
way
show,
back.
Yeah. I mean, just what you're talking about, The Late Lake Show was a procrastination tool that I would use with my parents when they'd be like, you know, I was like 5 or something, and it's like, all right, honey, it's time for bed, you know, and I'm like, but wait, who's this crazy cat? It's a Late Lake Show. Everybody sit down and get ready for this thing. You know, and I was just like, bullshit out of my ass. I would like drink a glass of whatever, you know, was going on. Because it was always like a, you know, my parents would have friends over or something like that. And I think the Late Lake Show was really born from I did not want to deal with the darkness and the like bore of trying to go to sleep.
Yeah. Oh, I get that.
Yeah.
Kids are so funny.
Your dad is Jewish.
My dad's a Jew.
Your mom is Protestant.
She is
exactly the same as me. My dad was Jewish. My mom was Protestant.
Well, my mom was raised
Protestant.
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of religion in my upbringing. That said, my mom was more kind of interested in the traditions and the pomp and circumstance, the beauty of what, you know, church offered. You know, she's very visual. She liked emotionally kind of being transported into a space that felt sacred. Like, I could see that she was like enamored of that kind of tradition. You know,
right.
she married a very gentlemanly, waspy, old money man. And like, really, we kind of, you know, that was how I was raised. And then my father, they were divorced by when I was one. So I always knew two vastly different households.
Did that, having parents divorce at that age, like, did that, what type of effect does that have on a child or on
Well, it pushes
life?
You to do the Late Late Show, is what it does. All of a sudden, you're like, I'm going to have to be quick. I'm going to have to think of shit here. But I will say, no, I think actually it's a huge, you know, there was a lot of personalities in my childhood. You know, I used to be like, oh, so dysfunctional. And it was. But I think what's most interesting about it is that the sort of young ability to kind of start to assess a strong personality or manage a myriad of them, vastly different people. I mean,
sure.
My dad is Jewish. He married a Catholic woman who was from sort of working class background in Philadelphia. My father is like a sort of wealthy Jew. And then my mom, who is like, has this like really interesting background, who came from a Jewish neighborhood, but then was raised ostensibly Christian and married an old money Ohio Christian, you know, Gentile, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have all with strong cultural ties to WASP culture. And my mom,
okay.
Yeah. So it's like there was just like, you know, you go to sort of Christmas to Philly and, you know, in the outskirts of the city and having a vastly different experience there. And then, you know, into
when you said WASP culture, the first thing I thought was racquetball.
Sure. Sure. You're seeing the sort of like a taut white short,
yes.
A starch, and then just a lot of sort of stiff, calculated movements towards a ball. Yeah. It sounds like very homoerotic in a way. Yes, you're correct. But I think that it's, yeah, there's just, I was immediately and always have been vastly obsessed with culture in general, cultural politics, the human condition within a culture. I loved other languages, other countries. I loved the idea of like going to other countries and being like, wow, now I'm immersed. I've been dropped into another sense, it's another reality, like the way that everyone speaks, looks at each other, talks, the way that their mouth moves. I mean, their face looks different, and it's like because they're speaking different languages which have different resonance, and they affect, you know, it's like the way that they eat, the way that they choose to sort of react to each other. It's just everything, the smells, everything. I just was very much immersed in and obsessed with that. And I think that's where I became really interested in storytelling and people, you know, and I like humans a lot and I'm interested in them and I want to see how they live in all different ways. So.
I get that. I mean, you also had kind of a big change as far as like where you were living. I mean, you were living originally in Manhattan, but then you moved to Florida.
Yes, very.
So
yeah.
What on earth? What kind of life change is that? That's got to be. How old were you when that happened?
I was like 11.
Oh my god.
Yeah, 11 or 12. So
that's a weird.
A
big, like,
such
a
weird,
weird move.
You're like, who am I?
In
like,
Florida,
what is
Florida of all places?
When
too.
When you found out you were moving, were you excited?
Well, the 11-year-old in me was like, oh, Florida. Okay, let me take that folder out in my head. What is Florida? And I just saw the image of like Disney World. And I was like, oh, that sounds good. Yeah, yeah. That sounds cool.
There's
yeah, surfing in Disney World.
There, yeah.
Beaches, right? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, cool, great. Oranges, I love orange juice. You know, let's do this.
Yeah.
And so it was very simple. And then, of course, the complexities of being in junior high, going from an all-girls school in New York City where
ooh.
It's like, you know, you have all these street smarts of like, you know, we wore all uniforms and it was like, they're nice parameters actually to kind of navigate the rest of the shit. So you're like, oh, okay, I know how to kind of take the crosstown bus to go to my tutor, you know, get a hot dog at the kiosk after, you know, it's like there was certain like understanding how the world works within these blocks. And then going to Florida where it's like, you know, first of all, junior high, boys, no dress code. You know, you're just like, I think dress code was interesting. I don't know why that's coming up, but I think that there's something interesting about the limitations that you have. There's something like, we're all kind of in it. We're all wearing the same outfit.
Right.
Right. So you're like, there's a safety in that.
There's a lot of safety in that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's no like competition really, you
yeah.
know?
Right. Yeah.
But then to go from that to like a regular
yeah, like
junior high
really
school.
Gendered too. You know what I mean? Like it's Florida.
Yeah.
So you're going into a space where I remember there was a story where my mom, I did fencing, of course, Chapin, Wasp.
That, how did that
There
start
you go. With the all-girls school on the Upper
shorts.
East Side. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of white. A lot of white. You're covered in
yes.
just like,
how
you get it. It's like a beekeeper, but like, you
literally
know.
Yeah. pick up fencing.
How did I that... picked up fencing through just because Chapin offered it and I thought it was cool. So I did it when I was a kid. It's kind of cool.
Hey, I get it.
Yeah. It's like you feel like you're like in Star Wars in some ways. And so then when we moved to Vero Beach, Florida, which is a tiny town, my mom was like, I want to... You know, things are going to change, a lot of changes, but at least she can keep up her fencing. And so she looked up in the white, yellow pages and, you know, saw a couple of ads and called up. And my mom being extremely WASPy in culture and kind of like sitting on the edge of her chair and, you know, very respectfully called a gentleman who answered the phone. Hello, you know, and she said, yes, my hello, fencing. She said, my daughter's been taking fencing for 2 years and I would like, we've just moved here from Manhattan and I would like her to continue. And the guy was silent for a long time and he was like, lady, we sell it by the yard. You know what I mean? And and that, I feel like, really encapsulates my mom, Robin Bell, in that whole move. So,
wow.
Yeah. And that really, you know, wow. So that was, she was like, oh, you know. And of course, you know, there's just a lot of adjustments and it was crazy. And I think I liked it because it was extraordinary. It was almost like living in Sweet Valley High, the, you know, the book, but yet also really hard. That's where you're going through all the shit where people think, you know, they're like mean yeah. and stuff, you know?
Yeah. How do you, what did you do to...
I was like scrawny and hairy. Like, I was very hairy.
It's a weird age to have to reestablish yourself in a whole new
yeah.
environment.
Yeah.
You know, that whole like almost middle school-y... type age, which is
rough.
A horrible time for anybody, but having
girls,
to go,
boys, everyone, yeah. we're all fucked. And in a way, that's nice, but it means like people are having, they have their defenses up, they're being mean, they're being popular or whatever.
You,
I just tried
did
to,
you feel like you were bullied?
I was just
time?
In the, I was, I, you know what I did? I kept it real. I kept it, I just, I was really good friends with some of the popular girls. And I was like a scrawnier until I didn't have like they had like cool boobs and stuff. You know, I was like
cool boobs.
Yeah, like super
Whoa,
cool.
Wait, what?
Yeah, you didn't know that boobs. There's cool boobs.
Cool
okay?
boobs.
When you're young and you have boobs, those are cool boobs. But basically, those girls were cool, and I aligned myself to be just like a good sidekick. I was, you know what I mean? I was from New York, so I was new. They were like, interesting. We'll help you get there. You know, I remember like being brought into the Acolyte. There was like an Acolyte after school thing that my mom sort of wanted me to be a part of.
Oh, God.
So all of a sudden, I, you know, my, I felt, I couldn't have felt more like Jewish in that moment. And I just being like, I was like really scrawny and like tan and I was very hairy as a kid. And like, you know, I was like, just like a rat. My eyeballs, my nose, and my mouth were huge. So I just had like huge features on a tiny head and then like massive like knees and just like gangly. It was a mess. And like we would go on this Acolyte on this trip to the water park. Oh, I remember dude. I was also small and there was all these like really kind of tall, big boned, blonde, you know, girls. And I,
cool
really
boobs.
Did they had cool boobs and they and I was so like the like one of these things is yeah. you know I was like doing his own thing and I was small and I remember the guy being in line to go on a some sort of slide or some shit and you know girl after girl would go and then he came to me and he just looked at me and he goes and he took a moment and he goes puedo, and he starts speaking to me in Spanish, and I was like, oh, I don't speak Spanish. And he was like, oh, and he just like thought he like it was such like a Florida thing where I was like, oh, so interesting. Like he just goes ahead and assumes that A, I just don't belong here or I speak a different language. He right. literally was like, do you know what I mean? There was like such assumptions. Yeah. It was such a different time, you know?
Right.
And then I was like, fucking A, I should have taken Spanish because it would have been so dope if I could have like responded.
Yeah.
I literally have wanted to learn Spanish since that moment.
Water you think it was because of your massive... Parks. Your massive knees?
I don't know. You just I felt like very cool. I just was like, because again, I was like the little kid who's obsessed with culture. So I was like, oh, I could go incognito. Like, this is so cool. Yeah. I could be like, no hablé español. You know, like, I just wish I had something to say back because it was like, I literally would fantasize about being, not like I wanted to be away from my family, but I wanted to be Spanish. Like, I literally had... Like, I want to be French. I want to be, you know, I want to be all these different things. And I had a journal where I remember after that particular moment, I like had this whole persona that I created based on what this man had said to me. I was like, I could be someone completely different. And that's, of course, my obsession of character.
Of course. Sure. Yeah. And with voices and impressions I was like, damn and sounds. It. And oh my God.
You've said that you feel comfortable being a fish out of water. And that you sort of thrive on that. And I'm like, what about being a fish out of water do you thrive on?
I think, well...
What makes you comfortable
moment,
and uncomfortable?
Yeah, like, I feel like in general, I've been... I think because I've had a great training from the myriad of people in my family and the different personalities, I feel like being exposed at a young age to a million different ways that people live, but then also... the humor in it. I feel like that's, you know, comedy for me is really born from what is truly excruciating and deeply, raw or painful or true and
sure.
very just like crystal clear. So I don't know, you know, because when I see things that are like really far-fetched, I'm like, I don't think it's so funny. You know, it's like that doesn't appeal to me as much. When it's like really intensely... sharply real, I feel like that is makes me laugh like uncontrollably. And I think being a fish out of water, the feeling of that makes you feel like you're immersed in someone else's story. And that is exciting to me. It's like all I lived in England. I went to drama school in England and was my only American at my college. I went to au pair at 13 years old. I went off to France to au pair, and I did not speak French at that point. And I just remember being like, wow, this is terrifying and also exciting. You know, it was a small town too, so nobody was like, in Paris and things like that, more cosmopolitan spaces, you're going to have people speaking English, but
sure.
This is like, nobody's fucking speaking English. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? And I just remember really craving that.
Early in your career, when you were starting out, you know, were there any kind of struggles you ran into early as you were trying to break in, or that roles you were being given? Like, what sort of struggles were you sort of facing?
Yeah, I mean,
in?
Absolutely. You know, I remember being like 18 or 19, and I came to LA to, you know, and a manager was hip pocketing me. She ended up representing me for a long, long time. She was amazing, but. I was still at drama school, and I remember coming out and being like, oh my God, I'm going to audition for like a guest star on Felicity, you know? And I was I will make it. And so I got a call back and I was like, oh, I've made it, you know? And I was like, I can't go back to drama school now. Like, this is it, you know? And I remember my manager.
So this happened while you were in drama school?
Yeah. And my manager, amazing woman, Joni Burstyn at the time, was like, you know, she was like, you got to go back to drama school. You can't stay here for this one moment. I didn't get the job, of course, but I was just like, you know, she was like, you need to. But I remember thinking like, oh, my God, I'm going to go to drama school. And during all of my hot years, I remember someone like saying like, is all like 19, 20, 21, 22, that I was just going to be there studying theater while all these other bitches are over there doing it. You know, I was like so upset. And that was like a very childish, very sort of like, you know, silly way to look at it. And I knew I had been writing since I was a kid, man. Like I had stories and you know, imaginary worlds and characterizations and like scenes and things that I had had in my head since I was little, you know, that I have journals of, you know, and I knew I wanted to do that, but I just felt a massive pull to be an actor initially. Like it just, like I wanted to be immersed in those worlds. I wanted to be fish out of water. I wanted to learn all those things and pretend to exist in those other spaces for real. I needed to feel that. But so drama school was very satisfying in that respect. I'm so glad I went back. I'm glad, you know, that I got to kind of express it that way. That said, when I came out of drama school and came to LA, it was like, culturally was such a shock going from, I remember at drama school, they do teach you how they prepare you, how to, you know, get ready for auditions. And, you know, and part of their thing was to wear all black so that, and no makeup, all clean face, so that you could be anything, right? Like mm-hmm. black box theater approach to any audition. Now, my manager set me up with some auditions and she was like getting feedback about me like being sort of barefaced, pulled back and all wearing all black. And she was like, what the fuck? She's like, did you wear all black? You were supposed to be like a bartender, you know, like a hot bartender for XYZ or whatever. And I was like, well, I was trying to just embody the character within my, you know, within my voice and my space. And she was like, okay. She was like, even if you, and this was really funny, different time, but she was like, even if you're playing a character that is like her husband just went away to jail, you know, the kids are screaming in the back and, you know, you're dying of a disease, you still have to have mascara and a push-up bra on, you know what I mean?
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? And I was like, what? And, you know, she's like, you have to be like the hottest version of that. And I was like, so it was a different time.
Even if you're dying, you have to look hot.
Yes. And this was like, I'm like a nobody who's like, sorry, I just did another knocking. Listen, I gesticulate a lot. The sounds you're hearing is my arms flailing around the studio and hitting shit. Okay, that's what all of that is. Okay, so if you hear it, that is me gesticulating. That's just how I roll.
This is so great.
But yeah, and by the way, that was another problem with the auditions early on, which was like I was using my hands so much because I was doing theater and I was like a big fucking, you know,
hitting people in the face.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So then I had to start sitting on my hands. That was when I think Allison Jones told me to do that.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, it was very silly. So those were the kind of things that I think, you know, I was a waitress. I paid my dues. I was a cocktail waitress at La Colonial. I remember Tori Spelling accidentally knocking a whole tray of champagne flugs on me.
Tori Spelling.
No, it was fine. She was having a great time. Listen, it was very tight in there. It was very tight.
Yes.
I was still learning. It's hard. Like that was like my worst nightmare to bring a tray of champagne flugs. It was just,
were you nervous having a job like that? Were you nervous about being seen by people in the industry that you were working as a,
No,
you didn't have any problem with that?
Oh, it's fine. I was like, we're all doing it.
Yeah, that's like the whole point.
I was like, yeah, I'm fucking waitress. Like,
yeah.
See you next Tuesday at the, you know, audition. It was fine. I actually took it very seriously. I'm a dork. I was like so excited. I was like, so I'm going to be the best waitress. I make sure that they have just what they need. Let me make sure. I'm going to check in. I'm going to be fun, affable. I might make a joke. I don't know. If they don't like it, I'll read the room. I'll walk away. You know what I mean? So I was into it. And then I was, modeling in London a bit, which was a whole nother can of worms.
What was that like?
That was like, I was hired, like the only thing you can do basically without a national security number for a job while you're at school is, one of them is modeling. Because it's not, you can't really say, well, you know, somebody else could do that. You could say, well, I'm fulfilling a I look like there's nothing I can do about it. I just am. They want to hire me based on just what my face, you know, whatever, what I look like. And, you know, I wasn't great at that. I was not like 8 feet tall and like, I wasn't actually like doing shows. And my mom was like a professional, like serious model.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And she was like, you know, during Twiggy days, she was like fucking amazing. I looked great, you know, whatever. I'm not going to like diss myself, but I think what was funny about it is that I got hired as like, it was a shitty, modeling agency that just did promotional stuff. So I did a couple of magazine things, but mainly my main gig, which some girl told me about from school. She was like, yeah, you could do this thing. It's called Promotional Girls. And I was like, what's that? You know, and she was like, you just, you know, she was like, oh, it's really easy. All you got to do is just kind of like dress up in stupid outfits and then like point people in the right direction of the bathroom or whatever. And I was like, okay, great. That's easy. So I would go to, you know, events and you just stand there like a dim, like a doofus in like a dumb outfit, and people would be like, where's the bathroom? You go, oh, it's like that, you know, and that was it. And I was like, cha-ching, and done, you know. I remember dressing up
as...
Would
it be the loo, though? It would be the loo, right?
It'd be the loo, yeah.
Yes.
It'd
yes.
be the, yeah, yeah, it was a water closet, you know. but, yeah, I've got to take a piss. But anyway, they yeah, I remember like one time being like dressed up as a, like a raunchy robot. At one point, oh, it was okay. like a whole robot theme. And I was kind of like, I can't tell if this is demeaning or awesome. Like, I was like, I'm really in the middle on this, you know? But yeah, I was at the Rugby World Cup once in a tent, like a VIP tent. And I was like, that seems kind of cool. And I remember cool. it was like, there was a VO, they had to announce a raffle, you know? And they're like, okay, so we're going to announce the raffle. You know, it was like some like really stodgy random thing. And, you know, I was supposed to be a promotional girl and like dancing or sort of just looking nice. And I wasn't dancing, actually. I wish I was. Got paid more. But no, I was just sitting there kind of showing people where the fucking buffet was and the whatever. And she had this mic and this woman's voice was just terrible. It was just like driving me crazy. And I was, you know, I'm a drama school student. And I just was like, hey, I just asked my manager. I was like, I know I'm just like a random person here, but can I do the raffle announcement? I'm, you know, I'm American. It's kind of fun. I could do like an announcer voice, and it's just, I'm just throwing it out there. And so sure enough, they let me do it. And I was like, ladies and gentlemen, you know, it's like, so, and they're like, what the fuck? And now we will announce the raffle winner, which is 4726, you know, it's like, and it was just like
so
a fun little
fun.
Things like that. You know, I would always try to oar myself in. I mean, I was an unaccompanied minor for many years uh-huh. on Delta, this Delta flight, because I would always see my dad every other weekend. And I convinced the ladies who I got to know very well on this flight to for me to do the announcement.
Oh,
yeah, that was
so
like my
fun.
First.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I was like 13. Yeah,
that is
and
so
I was like,
funny.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 106 flight Delta, blah, 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 you know, service to fucking whatever.
Keep listening because there's more to come with Lake Bell after this break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How did you get, like, how did you, what was your first voiceover job?
Here?
Yeah.
My first real one, I think, was like Peabody and Sherman or something. I played like a very tiny role.
Was that
Mona
like,
Lisa, I think I played or something. And there was like one small thing in Shrek where I was like, witch number 7. You know, it was just like small stuff. And it was, I had a voiceover agent because I had done radio plays in London.
Uh-huh.
CED, I think they were named.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that was really a long time ago. So I had like a demo that I was sent off with from drama school.
Was it hard for you to break into directing?
I think, I mean, I think it was a huge part of wanting to direct really came from wanting to play characters that I was excited to play. And I had written, I'd always been a writer, sort of closeted, you know, and then sort of came out to my representatives as a writer. I had wrote In a World First, and I brought it to my agents and said, I want to shop for directors on this and find someone to direct me in starring in this movie that I wrote for myself.
What did they say?
And so we started and we shopped and shopped, and it was like we couldn't quite find like the person for it. And my agent at the time, still my agent, Billy Lazarus, said to me, why don't you direct this? You said you wanted to direct, so why not now? And I was like, I would never, ever direct a feature if I haven't done a short film. And he was like, then write a short film and fucking direct the short film. And I was like, I gotta go, you know. So
oh,
I immediately got off the phone, wrote Worst Enemy, which I then cast. I just wrote it, sent it, you know, just like asked friends, found a producer, Jet Steiger, who ended up being my producer for my features. And I made it. I just invested myself and did that. And then that went to Sundance, and then it started. And it was like,
That's awesome.
Was a tester, because it was like, I think I can direct, but I don't have the audacity to take that on without sort of taking something bite size.
Yeah.
And so I did it, and then it became like a calling card, a visual and tonal calling card for me as when looking
move.
For. So it was really fun. It also was like a wise therapeutic move, like to do it so that I could confirm that I could.
And did you face any stigma or criticism? Sort of, you know, you were known as an actor. And then you're transitioning to writing and directing. Did you feel any criticism?
Well, listen, it's so interesting now because you have people doing it now. I mean, when I made In a World, I mean, there was no actors, actresses, let's say, writing and directing and starring and producing a film.
Yeah, you're
like
totally
it was
right.
just quite, it was like, oh, you know, and so I think part of the story of like in a world was like, oh my god, look at this actress doing this other stuff, you know, and that you know, it was very fulfilling. I felt it was beautiful to be received that way.
As a female, you didn't feel like, oh,
I did not personally.
Okay.
I think that because it was so novel, and because I had no doubt, I didn't walk into a room with an apology. I just didn't. So I didn't think it was weird. And, you know, I think I was definitely, my mom raised me to be like, yeah, do what you want to do. And
right.
don't, it's like, no, like it was just never even sort of, I was like, no, I'm telling you, this is what we're doing.
I awesome. You, that line, don't walk into a room with an apology is brilliant. What a great way to say it.
I think that
it's fantastic.
There is, that's how I felt about it. You know,
yeah.
It was like, let's just, so I'm like, you're welcome. I'm here.
Yeah. And what was so great about that film is, I mean, it basically encapsulated so much of you, because it got you as the voiceover actress. It got you as the, like, being able to do all the different types of voices,
like feminist.
And weird stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Feminist stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's got that. It's got you just showing off your talent as an actress. It's got your talent as a director and as a writer and producer. And it's got it's got so many aspects. Like, what a home run for a,
it was,
that doesn't happen all the time.
I know. And I feel really grateful to that. I remember, you know, winning, like being at the Sundance, sort of, they had the, you know, the festival has a closing ceremony and it's got some awards and stuff. And I was like, well, we got to go, 'cause it's my first Sundance and this is just the coolest thing I've ever, I mean, I'm in competition, but like, I don't expect anything, you know, I just was so happy to be there, you know? And I think, when they started talking about the screenwriting award, at Sundance Film Festival, you know, and I was just like, oh man, I can't wait. I think I know the one that I would have voted for, you know, they're talking about it and saying it's about this woman who, you know, takes on this, you know, sort of gendered world. And, you know, and I was just like, oh man, I like those days. That's a little similar to, right? You know, I just had no, and then they announced In a World, like, you know, Lake Belfort In a World. I mean, awards schmords, right? But like, it was being recognized in really in the coolest, you know, sort of indie way you could possibly be, you know, recognized. And I think I was very, I was so floored. And I remember getting up and being like, shit, because obviously I didn't prepare anything. And I was like, for a movie that is wholly about words and voice, I find myself speechless,
wow.
You know, and so that worked out. But I think it was really beautiful. And then it made it really hard for your second film because you're like, you're not gonna, you know, it's like you're gonna get. I felt like I knew making whatever I made, I felt like I was gonna get lacerated because I was like, it was just too golden. And I did. I got pretty slapped on my second film.
What was that like?
That sucked. But I also had dealt with it paled in comparison to the real what I was really dealing with, which was I almost lost my son. So it didn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
Sure.
How is your son?
He's great.
No,
he's great. Good. But that's why I can talk about it. But it's like I think that was such a
what a
profound lesson, you know, because it is all so big, isn't it? And it's all so sparkly and magic what we do, you know. And then there, you know, it is wise to take notice of reality and to center yourself. And whether you like it or not, you know, you have moments in life where you have to deal and wrestle with life or death, you know, and you have to, you know. It comes out of nowhere. And so I think going from, oh, God, I hope people like my second movie that I made, you know, to like, I hope I get to have this son, you know, and like,
right.
I think there's just.
It puts things into perspective.
It does. Sure. And it's like, yeah, it's super cliche, but it's super real. So it's cliche for a reason.
I have kids of my own and they've had their share of health issues. They're fine now, knock on wood. But I know you were talking about it. You had complications with both of your births with your kids, and I was just wondering how you dealt with that.
Well, I think this is a perfect example of it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you think it was like everything to me to think about. Oh, it's very exposing to put a piece of art out in the world, you know, whether it's funny or not funny or whatever it is. And you know, I poured years and years of my love and heart and soul into I Do Until I Don't, and I obsess over every detail, you know, and I there's just so much energy, like life force poured into a movie, you know, that you've written, you've directed, you've produced, and you star in, you know, it's
sure.
Like, it's just like, what? Like, it's so much that, you know, to be, I knew how vulnerable it was, and I knew that, you know, In a World was such a darling, and feeling the kind of, I knew people would be tough on me.
But it's like you could keep pushing the limits,
sure,
of those fish out of water moments. And you've done that like in your career as well. Like,
for sure,
you've thrown yourself into situations that maybe you weren't 100% comfortable with, but you're like, you're good at doing that, at putting yourself out there.
It feels like, I don't know, I feel like
it's
I
like
do crave
alive.
It. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Even just thinking about it, someone was like, oh, it's so interesting. You've gone from like indie filmmaking to network television, mm-hmm, you know? And I was like, well, it's kind of cool. Because then it's like, if you keep, just based on my interest, I mean, I'm like, I don't want to keep doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because we have all these wonderful different, we have a tremendous amount of mediums and genres and worlds, and I've always wanted to kind of like dabble with all of them. And so investigating the different limitations within those different mediums is compelling to me. So for instance, like, you know, indie filmmaking has a tremendous amount of limitations, but I always think that breeds creativity.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think like taking on network television, for instance, there's obviously a tremendous amount of limitations. But
I know like all three of us in this room have worked in this business, and we've all worked on projects that are near and dear to our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of these projects happen very quickly. Some other projects take a while. And
yeah.
I know with I Do Until I Don't, I think if I correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
but you know, this is something that you were working on for many, many years.
Many years.
And then ultimately it finally went, but, and I have worked on projects too that, you know, you write a script and it takes years until it finally gets made. You know, my question to you is, as a creator, how do you sort of, you know, keep going, and how do you not give up with that project? Like, what motivates you to keep pushing forward?
I really feel that I need to tell stories and need to continue to do those things, even when, you know, critics are going to punch me in the face and kick me on the ground, even though, you know, they don't know that, you know, you almost lost your son. They'll continue to write shitty things about the art that you've made. And, you know, it's like, it can be dark, you know, and I think if you let it get to you, or you can be intellectual, go, okay, that's okay. It's almost like when someone's angry at me, I have trouble with that. You know, it's like, I got to be okay with someone not liking what you made and or being angry at you. And that's like a massive life lesson for all people, you know.
Sure.
It doesn't mean that you're going to die, you know.
Yeah.
It means that you're alive, and very much so. People have opinions about you. Look at that. Ain't that great?
Exactly. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you this. You're a board member of Women in Film. What aspects of the film industry or society in general do you think we need to change for so that more women get opportunities to direct and DP and to
work? Absolutely. First of all, yeah.
That's a big question. But it is it's an amazing thing that you're a part of that.
I've been
organization.
I've been a board member for Women in Film. With Women in Film for a number of years now. And I think initially I was kind of like, oh yeah, I want to be a part of that. I don't even know what they do, you know? And then I got in there and I realized that what's profound about the work that they're doing, usually when you hear statistics about almost 90% of the statistics you hear being flopped around the internet, usually come from the research that we do. So not only are we actively sort of investigators, but then we also, we have a myriad of projects that help, not just like, we're not talking like, oh, there's this student who wants to get her first film made. We have support infrastructure for that.
Oh,
but
great.
It's mostly for mid-career women, right? You've made your second film, you're a well-known director even, but you've fallen off those lists in the radar because you're of a certain age or you're not being considered, right? There's also, because that is a huge, a lot of people are like, oh, they made their first film. Wow, look at that sparkly magic thing. Now, how do we build a career for that person where they're just a household name? Like, that's what's interesting that's not happening. And then the way that we're working hard is systemically, right? So you have to be, you have to create opportunity for board members or other educators to be within the studio systems. Like, for instance, I can tell you outright that, like, when staffing or finding directors or finding crewing up on shows, DPs and everything, there's a list. There's just a list for all of those things. And it just hasn't changed. It's just, and it's all dudes. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, okay. Like, as, you know, being a female filmmaker who makes this a priority, I was like, guys, you know what it means? It means it's going to take this much longer. We're going to meet, if we're meeting with three men that you like, great, I want to meet them. We are then going to meet with three women who are totally qualified to be in this room. So maybe they're just not on that list, but they have done all the same credits. Okay. So, and they're appropriate candidates. So we did that with every single department head. And then I'm very proud to say that we have the Reframe stamp, which is basically like a stamp of approval from the Women in Film institution in general on this industry to have equal, just full parity in all above the line department heads.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's phenomenal.
It's great. It's an easy thing to do. It's easy things to strive for on your production. You'd be like, oh, I want the Reframe stamp. You know what I mean? Like, that's a great incentive to kind of put your money where your mouth is a little bit.
That's amazing. One other question I had before we wrap up is your movies In a World, I Do Until I Don't, and Bless This Mess all sort of tackle difficult subjects, but through a hopeful lens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my question to you is, why is it important for you to bring a message of hope to your work?
I feel like there's a lot that's shitty in the news and around us, and has, I've always felt like it's really easy to be mean and to be blue. And I think it's much harder to mine for comedy in what is light and what is kind in spirit. And I've always made that a challenge. And ultimately, if it's the simple difference of like, okay, a viewer has ingested something that I've put out there in the world, and then they feel a certain way when they leave that, you know, imaginary space. They get in their car, someone cuts them off. It's the difference between them being like, well, fuck you, or don't worry about it, buddy. You got it. Have a good day. You know, like that, the simplicity of just affecting someone in that way, it means the world to me. So I think it's like sometimes I feel overwhelmed, like so many people do. God, what can I do? Shit. You know, you can only donate so much money, you know, and I do, and I volunteer, and I'm a participant in the world, and I am philanthropic in all those ways. But I feel like, how can I use the thing that I do to make the world a little bit better? And that would just be, I hope, you know, to kind of produce entertainment and create content that makes the human person feel good.
As someone who has had their fair share of roadblocks and has never given up, what advice do you have for people who may be struggling either personally and professionally in their lives and their career to keep going, to stay motivated?
I feel like we are... I'm such a team player. I feel like you don't have to do everything all by yourself, alone in a dark room.
And like we're doing right now.
Like right now. It's not that dark. Let's really paint a picture for people. It's pitch black, guys. Yeah. Get me out of here. I think people often feel like I have to do all of it, you know? And I do think, I'm telling myself this too, you know? So, because I do feel that I have to do all of it. I'm a mom, you know, a writer, a director, an actor, a producer, you know, it's like I have to make lunch, you know, just a certain way before I do the, you know? And I would just say that, you know, I wouldn't have sort of had the belief in myself to go and take on these things if I hadn't had these pivotal moments with others, with people who believed in me, you know. So to listen to good advice and to not ignore it because you think you're not doing it on your own, and that you won't get credit as much if you do it, you know, with the guidance of someone else.
That makes a lot of sense. It is a absolutely incredible pleasure to hang out with you and hear all your thoughts. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for coming out
and
sharing time in our little black box.
Yes, indeed.
Never Surrender is produced by Western Sound. Executive producers are Jack Hergoth, Stephen Kramer Glickman, and Ben Adair. Producers are Sabrina Fang and Cameron Kell. Music by Hannes Brown.
On social media, you can check us out on Instagram at Never Surrender Pod, on Twitter at Surrender Pod, and on Facebook at Never Surrender Podcast. You can also email us at neversurrenderpodcast@gmail.com to share your own stories about how you struggled, failed, and ultimately never surrendered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.